Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dr. Stephen Pantelet, Professor of Clinical Medicine in the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, where I hold the Alan M. Cates and John M. Bernard Endowed Chair in Palliative Care and serve as the founding director of the UCSF Palliative Care Program. Today's program is generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org and the foundation at chcf.org. Today's discussion will focus on the healthcare debate and the emerging focus on end-of-life decisions. Where do practice and policy intersect? We have a panel here today that will explain the practice of palliative care in hospice, discuss the benefits of this type of care, and explore the best policies and practices for caring for those with terminal illness. Despite an ideal vision of the end of life that we have in the United States, where we die at home, free from pain and suffering, and surrounded by our loved ones, the reality is that most Americans die in hospitals or nursing homes, alone and in pain. And the saddest part of this reality is that it doesn't have to be this way. We have the knowledge and skills and ability to make it different if we would put those into practice. The challenge is that we live in a culture and have developed a medical system that sees death as failure and optional. And I want to share a story with you of a patient that we took care of at UCSF. Mrs. May, that's not her real name, was a 76-year-old woman with widely spread cancer. Chemotherapy had stopped working for her. She was living at home with her family, who was taking care of her. She was getting weaker. One morning, when the family woke up and checked on her, they found that she was very short of breath, in a lot of pain and a lot of distress. They got worried. They called 911, and the ambulance brought her to our emergency department. In the emergency department, one of the well-meaning physicians asked, "Would you like us to do everything possible for your mother?" To which they replied, "Yes, of course." Because the emergency doctors and nurses didn't really know a lot about palliative care, their thought of doing everything possible was to call the intensive care unit, because she was really sick. And the intensive care unit team was on their way down to see her. They were planning to put in big IVs into her neck. They were going to put a tube down her throat on a machine that would breathe for her. They were going to give her lots of medicines, do lots of tests, draw blood and cultures, put her in the intensive care unit where she'd be in a glass booth, essentially, lots of monitors, lots of machines, two family visitors at a time. Is this really what Mrs. May wanted? I mean, there was no way to know from her at the time. Is this really what her family wanted for her in bringing her to the hospital? Is this good care, even if it was technically proficient? And is this what any of us would want for ourselves or our family members in a similar situation? And finally, apropos to the title of today's presentation, would this be considered a good death? Now, the question really sounds like an oxymoron when you think about a good death. There really is no good death. Fundamentally, death is sad, and it is filled with grief and loss and suffering. And while the question may be a useful one to think about what might constitute a better death, that may be the better question, rather than what is a good death. And the goals of medicine then are not so much to have a good death or to help people have a good death, but really to relieve as much suffering as possible, to promote dignity, and at the very least to not add to suffering by the interventions and by the treatments that we offer. So I want us all to think for a moment about our life as a plane flight. So if you think of your life as a plane flight, We recognize that, you know, when the plane's taking off, you need a lot of attention. The crew really has to be focused. The pilots need to be on top of things. The crew needs to be paying attention. Just like at birth, sometimes we need a lot of help from the medical system. Sometimes we don't. But mostly the flight goes pretty smoothly. Yeah, there's some turbulence here and there. Pilots and crew need to pay attention. Mostly it goes well. And then it's at landing that you need a lot of attention again. You need the pilots to be paying attention so that you don't overshoot the runway and that people pay attention. And the challenge is that we know that every plane must land and every life must come to an end, but the medical system doesn't always recognize that. and has this idea that the planes can just stay aloft forever. And that's really what was happening to Mrs. May in the emergency department. Three of her four engines went out. The plane was about to come down. And here they were trying to keep her aloft somehow and not really either not knowing that it was time to land the plane, not knowing how to land the plane, and doing what they knew how to do. How much better if she could have had a crew that really knew how to land the plane, that knew the plane is about to come down, the airport is within sight, and it's time to land this plane. Unfortunately, the overwhelming bias in our healthcare system is on prolonging life at any cost. While effective in many situations, this approach fails to serve people at the end of life. And instead of hope and dignity, compassion and caring for people nearing the end of life, our system too often provides treatments that people, frankly, don't want and that really can't help them. And it becomes a source of suffering rather than the source of the relief of suffering. And there is a better way. That's the good news. And the better way is palliative care. Palliative care is that field of medicine that provides comprehensive care focused on the quality of life for people living with life-threatening illness and for their families, that assures physical comfort and support and is provided alongside all other medical treatments. The focus really then is on the quality of life. And how could we have promoted the quality of life for Miss May? Abraham Lincoln said it best when he said, "It's not the years in our life, but the life in our years that matter." And the question is whether that's measured in hours or weeks or months or years, how do we promote quality? Now, I've talked to you about what's sort of the bad news about this, how we take care of people at the end of life. But there's actually great reason to be very optimistic about this as well in our society. There's been tremendous growth in palliative care and in a focus on this area over the last 20 years. The pilots are learning and the crew are learning how to do this better. The airports are being changed and the passengers are learning about what the options are. So let me just give you some idea about that. In California in 2000, one in five hospitals offered palliative care services. Today, it's doubled to more than one in three hospitals. So that's been tremendous. Palliative medicine is now a recognized medical specialty. That's only 2 years old, but that's a tremendous advance as well. And thousands of nurses have been trained to provide palliative care through LNEC, a program that one of our panelists has helped to develop. And thousands more patients are using hospice services today than were 20 years ago. At the same time, individuals, hospitals, healthcare systems, and foundations like the California Healthcare Foundation that is sponsoring this talk today have invested in palliative care tremendously to ensure that doctors and nurses are trained, that hospitals and other healthcare institutions provide this care, and that patients all across the country have access to this kind of care. And while there's been a great deal of progress, there's still a lot more to be done. And what we'll be talking about today is both the great progress that has happened and the great opportunities and needs that remain. We'll examine palliative care as a response to suffering for people with serious and life-threatening illness and those who are dying, and talk about how to discuss end-of-life issues to ensure that we and our loved ones can get the best care possible. I want you to remember Mrs. May. We'll return to her story, and I'll tell you how it unfolded a little bit later. But I'd like now to introduce our panelists and get to your questions. Sitting here to my left is Sharon Fernikes Jeans. Sharon is a licensed clinical social worker and manager of social work services and spiritual care at Eden Medical Center in Castro Valley, California. Ms. Fernikes Jeans is also the POLST Coalition Project Director for Alameda and Contra Costa Counties. POLST stands for Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatments and is a way for patients to document their preferences for care that is recognized throughout California in all care settings. Next to Sharon is Judy Sitko. Judy is the Executive Director of the California Coalition for Compassionate Care. Ms. Sitko has nearly 20 years of experience in healthcare. Before joining the coalition, she worked as a lobbyist. She's also a lawyer and has worked also as a computer programmer for hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, and managed care providers, and has been working in the area of end-of-life and palliative care for many years. And at the end of the table, Kathy Kelly, coordinator for LNEC, which is the End-of-Life Nursing Education Consortium, geriatric program at the City of Hope, which is an NCI-designated comprehensive cancer center in Duarte, California. The LNEC project is a national nursing education initiative to improve end-of-life care. Over 9,000 nurses from all 50 states and 53 countries around the world have taken LNEC training to improve end-of-life care. So let me start with a question for our panelists. Why should we talk about a good death? I mean, why is that even a relevant conversation, and what can we learn from even talking about this topic? And Kathy, maybe I'll start with you.
Why should we talk about a good death?
Mm-hmm.
I think that all of us, when we have seen or experienced the suffering of others through life, when we know it when we see it, don't we? We know when perhaps could have done better, when suffering was prolonged in some way. When I think about it, how can we alleviate suffering from a nurse's point of view? Nurses are probably the healthcare professional that have the most time or most often at the bedside. So we witness a lot of that suffering, as well as we have an opportunity to be advocates and perhaps intervene and communicate with members of our healthcare team, with physicians and our social workers and others to help clarify those communications. So it's our mandate. We want to alleviate the suffering. And I guess what I think about it is we want to help alleviate the fear. We can't always remove all suffering. Mm-hmm. But we can help alleviate the fear. We can create a climate of safety in a way so that the person who's dying feels that their needs will be taken care of. And that's one of the big things is fear of pain and suffering at the end of life. And if you can create that place of safety or comfort, it allows for a healing or a compassion area where people then go on and live their daily life right up until the day they die. They have a good quality of life. So that's what I think about when I think about suffering and nursing's role in that.
Judy, from your perspective?
Well, when you look at it from a societal perspective, people are living and dying. They're dying very differently than we have in the past. I mean, death is nothing new. As long as people have been around, people have been dying. And yet we're still here today grappling with how do we make this as peaceful and smooth and make it the process that people want. If you look at 100 years ago, people usually lived into their 40s or so. They died suddenly from an infectious disease. Today, most people, when they pass, they have multiple chronic conditions that they've lived with for many years. So we have a unique time in the history of mankind to really look at death and what does that mean for living? What does that mean for us as individuals? We have this prolonged period of time of loss of physical ability, and yet a lot of people, what we're finding is it's an opportunity to explore some of the other areas of their personality, their individual, their spirituality, their psychosocial aspects. And so I believe that's one of the reasons why we're here today.
Sharon?
From the social work perspective, and doing this every day in the hospital, meeting with families to talk about what would your loved one want now that they can't speak for themselves, no one talks about it. No one wants to talk about it. They're waiting for someone else to bring it up. But people know that it's going to happen, and it's a really difficult time when you're in the middle of the crisis or an event that's just happened to have that conversation with someone. So I feel that it's truly a gift to be able to do this ahead of time with your family members and loved ones so that when the crisis occurs, you get to focus just on that moment and on that grief or on that love or that touch or whatever you're doing instead of having to come up with the what-ifs in life or what can I do or what would they have wanted. It causes a lot of frustration. A lot of families end up leaving the hospital angry. They don't talk to each other again because they've had to try to come up with an answer in a time that is not a good time to try to make that decision. It takes a burden off the family to know that I've already talked about this with my mom or I've talked about this with dad, and this is what he wanted. We're all in agreement, and we're doing the right thing so that then you can just focus on being available for that person that may be dying.
Right, thank you. So in talking about this as a gift, really, and this conversation as a gift, and we also talked about palliative care and hospice, and I'm wondering if we could talk more about sort of how do they help? You know, what is actually happening in that through the conversation? And I mean, Kathy, and the kind of care you described, relieving of suffering, sort of what happens in the provision of palliative care that helps that way? And Is it just for people like Mrs. May in the story, or is it really available to other people? Kathy, maybe you can address that.
It's available to all of us. I don't know, perhaps like many of you, my parents are in their late 80s, and they have chronic health conditions, and I tried. It happens with many healthcare professionals, not nurses and others, but I wanted to have I live here, they live in the Midwest, and I'm the oldest, so the family had to wait until I came home in order to have this conversation. I don't know if that's happened to any of you, but my sister said, well, we just don't know how to talk about it. So one morning at breakfast, I sat down with my parents and said, my brother and, Kate and Jim are having trouble talking to you about this. Have you thought about it? And they said, oh, yes, we have. But they had not, it's not an easy conversation to have in every day. And even healthcare professionals, I found, I had to say, well, tell us what you want. And so it's good to have, as Sharon says, it's good to have that conversation before it's a crisis. Because when it's in a crisis, you need a little time to process everything and think about what you want. I recently also read an article about a married couple who had not talked about their end-of-life wishes. He wanted comfort care, and the wife wanted them to do everything. And they had never talked to each other about that. And they were both looking at the end of life. So these are, how do we start those conversations? As a nurse, when I'm out with patients, I think I listen to what they say. When we try to be sensitive to that, I have my own thoughts and feelings and experiences, but when I'm with a patient, in order to give good palliative care and to be part of a good team that's carrying that care, I need to listen to what the patients say and help them communicate that. And we are going to talk about advance directives and getting them to fill out that. I will say my mother has an advance directive. She was very proud of that. And I said, well, Mom, where is it? She's with our will. It's with the will. So that's not going to follow her to the hospital,
Unless you can stop at the bank first.
Right. We're going to stop there, get it out, yeah.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're talking about care at the end of life and how to make the best decisions about that care. Our panelists are Kathy Kelly, coordinator for the LNAC End of Life Nursing Education Consortium Geriatric Program at the City of Hope, Judy Sitko, executive director of the California Coalition for Compassionate Care, and Sharon Fernikes-Jeans, licensed clinical social worker and manager of social work services and spiritual care at Eden Medical Center in Castro Valley, California. I'm Dr. Stephen Panilat, professor of clinical medicine in the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. So we were just talking about this issue about how palliative care helps and how people access it, and is it just for Mrs. May? And Judy, from sort of policy, your perspective.
Yeah, from a policy perspective, people still are confused today. Even in the healthcare, even healthcare providers, there's still a bit of confusion about the difference between hospice and palliative care. So I'd like to first explain hospice and how it came about, because if we understand the roots, then we can understand why we needed palliative care. Hospice came about in the 70s when there was an increased number of people dying from cancer, and they were going through very aggressive treatment, and there was a sense that there was a clear point in time when the treatment was no longer effective, and the medical system had no way of really shifting to meet that change in need. So that's where hospice was born. It was based on the model of people who die from cancer, where you've got a very clear, aggressive treatment. We can cure this. And there's a clear point in time when there's a switch. Curative is no longer the approach. And that's where hospice was born. So it was created by Congress as a Medicare benefit. And they were concerned about every Medicare beneficiary wanting to get hospice services. So they put some very important restrictions on it to keep it limited. And they said, one, you have to forego curative treatment. You can only get hospice if you're only getting hospice services and not trying to cure any underlying condition. Two, you have to have a six-month prognosis. And I've spoken to people who were involved in that legislation. They said that number was pulled out of a hat. It had nothing to do, there was no clinical basis at all for that number. It was just a number people could agree on to get the legislation into place. So hospice has developed over time, and we've become comfortable with it as this very wonderful model of interdisciplinary care. It involves a team of a physician, nurse, social worker, chaplain, caring for the person holistically and making sure that there's managing symptoms and making the last days of life as full of life as possible. Now, a lot of people could benefit from those services, but they're not ready for hospice. Either they don't meet those criteria, or psychologically, they're not ready to forgo care, curative care. So that's where palliative care came in. Palliative care came about as it's the same philosophy, the same style as care, but it's not limited like hospice. It's not in policy, it's not a licensure category, and it's not a Medicare benefit. Hospice is, palliative care is a philosophy. And the whole purpose of palliative care was to break out of the hospice box. But a lot of people struggle with getting their hands around it because it's out of the box, and people want to put it back in the box, and it gets back associated with end of life. Palliative care, by definition, is not limited to end of life. It's anyone who would benefit from symptom management, quality of life, holistic care, and it can be provided at the same time as curative treatment.
Thank you. Sharon, do you want to talk about from your from your perspective at the bedside?
About how?
In the hospital, about palliative care and how it's provided, and is it just for someone like Mrs. May? And we heard about sort of hospice services from Judy and how palliative care grew up, but what's your experience sort of at the bedside and
so,
in a hospital?
Working in a hospital, oftentimes the social worker gets called in when there comes a time to make a decision or a point where there's some disagreement. And it's oftentimes not with, like Judy was saying, a six-month diagnosis or less, but maybe more of a progressive disease that's happening, and families want to sit down and talk, or they don't want to sit down and talk and need to sit down and talk, and I'm asked to go in and help facilitate that. So often we start off, and I like to hear stories from people, so it's easier to get people to talk if you can ask them about their family, their kids, how did they grow up, what was their life like, so that you get to understand their own personal values and approach them from their own cultural beliefs and where they're coming from. So my job is to really try to meet them where they're at without, and lots of times I go in, I'm not sure what direction this is going to go in or whether we're going to even come to an answer today. But it's I always try to look at it as like a seed that you plant to start discussion and open up on that, and then we can always come back again and talk further. But it is the place, unfortunately, it seems to start in the hospital rather than before people got there. So palliative care can be just talking about the discussion and working a little bit toward advanced life planning around advanced health care directives, and then moving on to discuss more diagnosis issues.
We have a question here from the audience related to your point. How do you initiate the conversation, especially when your elder parent is reluctant and avoiding it, or you're not so elder parent?
Can we answer that?
Please.
No. So that's a very good question, and we often get that in the hospital. Well, my mom doesn't want to talk about it, or we don't want to talk about it in front of her. So sometimes we step out of the room and we talk about it without the patient, and I try to get to know why it is this person doesn't want to talk about it. Is it really that they don't want to talk about it, or does the adult child not want to talk about it with their parent? Is there cultural beliefs around death? Some people, if you talk about death, it's bad. I mean, maybe that means that's going to happen. So in some cultures, they don't want to talk about that. So really have to understand where that's coming from and try to work with the family unit to make sure that it's not their own feelings, and then to help give them the tools to be able to talk about it. Sometimes I offer to go in and why don't I start the conversation? We can start this way. But it's really finding out where that person is and finding out, does that patient, sometimes they say, well, will you go talk to her first, then I'll come in. And so I'll go in and talk, and I usually start with, what has the doctor told you? What's going on? And almost always, not always, but almost always, they know exactly what's going on. They know exactly that their daughter doesn't want to talk about it, and they'll tell me, oh, no, my daughter doesn't want to talk about it. That's why she went and got you to come here and talk. But I know what's going on. A lot of smarter and wiser and a lot more insightful than people are given credit for sometimes.
Kathy?
Well, I was just going to say, it's been my observation that people want to know, like they don't want to enroll in hospice until they know they're dying. It's like they have to have some clear sign that they're doing it. And so you don't want to have that conversation about dying unless you know you're really dying. The trouble is that our ability to say when we're going to die, when that plane's going to land, is very hard for any of us to do. So it is a challenge, and it's very good, as Sharon said, to go in and say, well, what do you understand about this? And then just listen and let, you know, ask and tell, I think is what someone said. So, and sometimes, if you know it's coming, I think I heard something about the 40-70 rule. If you're 40 and your parents are 70, you need to just start talking about that.
Can I add one thing?
Please.
One thing that we've found helps to move these conversations a little bit more upstream is asking the individual if they had an experience with a loved one who died, and how was that? So using an example, talking about somebody else's death, whether it was good or whether it was very difficult, that's a good way to break the ice.
Thank you. Wonderful ideas for how to get those conversations going. I want to return for a moment now to the story of Mrs. May, who I introduced earlier. She's the 72-year-old woman with a widely spread cancer who was living at home, brought to the emergency department by ambulance when she became short of breath at home and was having a lot of pain. And when we left her story, the emergency room physician was about to call the intensive care unit team to come and put in the IVs and a tube down her throat on a machine that would breathe for her, draw blood, get x-rays, and so on. It just so happened that they called the medicine team down simultaneously, and the medicine team just got there faster. And one of my colleagues was the physician on. He was one of the palliative care physicians. And took one look at the situation and thought, wow, are we really doing the right thing here? And looked at the family and said, you know, your mom is very sick. They said, yes, we know. Said, you know, she's so sick that she's dying. Yes, we know. In fact, we brought this bag of new clothes to dress her in her new clothes for her journey to the next life. Well, if that's what's important for her and for you, there's a better way to go about that than to put her in the intensive care unit and do all these procedures. And they said, well, that sounds good to us. And so right there in the emergency department, they dressed her in new clothes. Instead of moving her to the intensive care unit, they moved her to one of our comfort care suites that we have at UCSF. We have two rooms that look more like home, designed for people who are needing palliative care, who may be at the end of life, but still need to be in a hospital like Mrs. May did. Moved her upstairs, got her pain and shortness of breath under control with medicines. 30 family members came into the room, stayed with her. A few hours later, she died very peacefully, and her family was incredibly grateful. This was exactly what they wanted. And when they said, yes, do everything possible, it was with a very different image in their minds. And by asking the right questions and providing the right kind of care, she, in fact, did have the kind of experience that her family had hoped for. And with that sort of story in mind, and there are a number of questions that sort of get to this question about what do you do with these directives? Assuming we can have these conversations and assuming that Mrs. May's family knew exactly what they wanted to happen, how do you ensure that this really does happen? You know, where should the advance directive be? That's a really good question. What if the doctors don't follow it? How do you ensure that this information is available when you need it? And Kathy, why don't we sort of turn to you?
I did speak about my mother's advance directive being with her will, which is not very convenient for people. It's hard to follow. I don't know if any of you, you know, I hope you've filled out advance directives. but, you know, it's more general. So that's another reason why it's good to communicate with each other, so that if you, say, my husband were unable to speak and he had spoken to me, you know, if he wanted to be put on the ventilator or on a feeding tube, or my parents, if they're offering care that we consider a burden, it's burdensome or futile care, then the person who has your proxy can speak for you. Now, maybe I was going to talk to Judy or Sharon, because there's a form now in California since January of 2009. We now have the physician's orders for life-sustaining treatment. And maybe you want to talk more about those, but I think they're wonderful. It's a wonderful document. And I also think it's a good document just to talk about what kind of interventions could happen to someone if they suddenly became very, very seriously ill and they were taken to the hospital. So I would appreciate you talking about the pulse.
First, just in general, if you want to ensure that your wishes are honored, I would recommend to speak to all of your loved ones. Whoever might show up at that hospital, is particularly if there's anybody that you're estranged from and has unresolved issues with you, those are the people that are going to show up at the bedside and say something different, and the healthcare system is going to stop and say, okay, let's pause and sort this out. So the best thing is a live person at the bedside representing your wishes is the best way to ensure it. As Kathy mentioned, the advance.
Can I, just for one moment, there was a question about what about people who don't have blood relatives? So you said someone at the bedside. Is there any restriction on who that can be, or you know, what do people do who don't have families, for better or worse, maybe? But what do they do?
Well, if you, there's a lot of different angles on this. If you do have someone, you can name anyone you want to be your agent. So it could be a friend, it could be a colleague, almost anybody could be your agent. And if you name that person in your advance directive, that's the one that will be speaking for you. Now, if you don't have an advance directive, then the healthcare team will turn to the closest available relative. And that's how it's established by law. So as a practical matter, if you don't have any relatives around, you know, the healthcare providers, they're going to look to anybody who shows up who seems to care about you to help provide some guidance. So going back, as Kathy mentioned, with an advance directive, there's really two components. Is one is naming your agent to speak for you, and we encourage everyone who's 18 or older to do that. The second part is to put down what your wishes are for your treatment. And that's the part that Kathy mentioned was a little broad and can be vague. And that can be helpful to the healthcare team, but a lot of times we found that information is not specific enough to really guide the care. Now, it can be helpful to establish certain values, what's important, and then they can use that to kind of apply to your situation. But because the advance directives have been vague in that way, the Coalition for Compassionate Care has taken the lead, along with a number of local communities and through funding from the California Healthcare Foundation, to establish POLST in California. It's the bright pink form. And POLST complements an advance directive because it is a physician's order. It's standardized. There's one form. So when healthcare providers see it, they know if this box is checked, this is what it means. And it addresses the typical life-sustaining measures that come up towards the end of life, including resuscitation, ventilation, and feeding tubes and antibiotics. So POLST, because it is a physician's order, it's established in law, all healthcare providers, if someone has it, they are required by law to honor that. And we are in the process of making sure that the whole healthcare system is set up and prepared both to help people execute POLST forms and prepared to honor those.
And what's really good about it is it's to follow the patient. That form is to follow you so that it should go. Say you are in a nursing home and went into the hospital, the POLST would go with you. And hopefully that clarifies that communication at the end of life about what you would want.
Thank you, Kathy. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're talking about making end-of-life decisions and palliative care. Our panelists are Kathy Kelly, coordinator of the LNEC End-of-Life Nursing Education Consortium Geriatric Program at the City of Hope, Judy Sitko, executive director of the California Coalition for Compassionate Care, and Sharon Fernikes-Jeans, licensed clinical social worker and manager of social work services and spiritual care at Eden Medical Center in Castro Valley, California. I'm Dr. Stephen Panalad, professor of clinical medicine in the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Sharon, I wanted to turn our attention now maybe to the more sort of clinical, sort of practical issues here. And there's a question about describing sort of the physical care that is palliative. You know, what is actually done for patients to help them be comfortable to relieve their suffering on a practical level?
I would turn to Kathy for that one.
All right, yeah. Thanks.
Or to Stephen. I mean, the main thing at the end of life, what do you think of? Well, we think of that, will we be in pain? Well, we have symptoms that cause us distress. Not only the person who's dying, but can cause distress to our family. So one of the major calls in providing palliative care and in good compassion and life care is to relieve the physical pain. And we have many good tools and medications that can do that. We can help relieve shortness of breath. There's a lot we can do that way. And then the other, so once, as I said, once those we can manage those physical symptoms, I think it helps people feel safe. You know, and then, I mean, if you've been in pain and you're really tired because you haven't been able to sleep, suddenly you can sleep. Suddenly you have enough energy to talk to your sister who you haven't seen for, you know, 5 years. Suddenly, well, not suddenly, but maybe you have more energy just to, look out the window and enjoy the beautiful day or take care of your financial things, things that you feel you want to take care of. These are things that help you complete your life. Other people, nurses sometimes help people go through life review. And that helps people validate their life. And I also think good symptom management, that palliative care, we palliate, we make better those symptoms, can also free up caregivers so that they have a feeling of confidence that the symptoms their loved one is going through or their good friend, or if you're in a nursing home and nursing assistants are taking care of you, that they also have confidence that you're being cared for in the best way possible. So we can manage those, and that's why it is good to think about what you'd like in advance and maybe recognize signs of dying or when people are really starting to feel earlier. So.
And part of the palliative piece that I could speak to, not around symptom management, but is about the complementary medicines that could go along with palliative care, such as, but not always everywhere, would be massage or music that you could bring into the room. We have CD players available that you can bring that in at bedside, something that they really enjoy, your loved one loves, because that's really what the focus is now, is enjoying the last moments of life. Getting in a spiritual counselor, either someone, if the person was religious or not religious, depending on what their preferences are. So we help coordinate, so that's part of the whole entire team that's available to help, like you said, validate life. Talk about the good stuff, focus on the fun stuff, focus on making sure that you get family there that needs to be there, possibly depending on where this person is at their end-of-life journey, and working with the families on unresolved issues that they might have that they need to be focusing on at this time.
Well, I have a good death. I have a story of a good death, and that is a gentleman who lived a good, long life. He was in his 90s, and he was he had been a teacher, but he had another occupation, but he wrote music. So it was very important to him. So people he had written music for came to his hospital bed, and they sang to him some of the songs that he had written and created, which was wonderful for him. And then he wanted to go home, and he was able to go home. His whole family came and was with him, and he just slipped away. And his family, his widow, everyone felt he had a good death. I mean, that's one of the ideals, but that's addressing the physical symptoms. It validated his life. There was the music that was important to him. And then he got to be home, which was where he wanted to be. So that's a good death.
And I think you both made a really important point, which is until you relieve the physical symptoms, you can't address the other things. And that's why knowledge and education around pain management and relief of shortness of breath and nausea and fatigue is so important. Because when someone's sort of in the grips of that, they really can't focus on anything that's really important. I mean, the pain is just there in the way of what's really important and what people want to focus on. And so we as doctors and nurses, social workers, we have to be really good at managing those symptoms as a first step so that we can then ensure that people have the opportunity, the focus, the kind of the ability really to focus on the things that really are important, like saying goodbye and doing the things they want to do, accomplishing what's left to accomplish. There have been several questions here about sort of, in essence, what's getting in the way of people getting good palliative care? Sort of what is the problem? And there's a few specific comments, and I'd like us to think about this question generally sort of from a policy perspective, also a practical perspective. But one question is, what if anything can be done to counter the prevalent American attitude that palliative care is somehow a cop-out or for losers? And we certainly hear that, I heard someone say the other day that the oncologist walked in the room after the patient said he was tired of chemotherapy and wanted palliative care, and the oncologist walked in the room and said, I didn't know you were a sissy. Which is really shocking to hear that a patient sort of went to that point and felt that way, and it was really more about the doctor than the patient. But so thinking about that, and you know, why isn't this information sort of better available? Every time we go to any hospital, any doctor's office, why don't we get information about this? What are the policy issues? So maybe we can address that. How do people access this information about this service, and how do they access the service, and what can be done? So Judy, do you want to start?
Well, I think part of, from a healthcare system and policy perspective, what's the barrier is our healthcare system is really very good at being task-oriented, procedure-oriented, looking at the person and the disease as cutting it down into a little body part that then gets treatment. We are extremely good at that. We have led the world in that. That has what makes our healthcare system as powerful and wonderful as it is today. It's also the biggest barrier to us getting a more holistic approach to our healthcare. So what I see is we're at this great time, I think, where we are transitioning our healthcare system. We've really perfected that of doing the surgeries, doing the procedures, going in and taking care of things and being done with it. But we're realizing we've starting to hit the wall on the success of that, and that when even after those treatments are done, the question is, can the person go home? Can they live the way they want to live? And we're at this point where our healthcare system is trying to grapple with meeting both of those needs. So I think that's just a barrier to be aware of. And as Steve had mentioned early on, there is a lot that has happened in the last 15, 20 years. And it's an exciting time, and I think we're going to see a lot of change in the next 5 or 10 years.
I would say, too, it's everybody's responsibility. It's all of us. It's you. It's me. It's the doctors. People don't want to talk about it, and people are have hope and want to make sure that everything's been done. But it's there's a statistic out there that doctors aren't talking about it. The patient's waiting for the doctor to talk about it, but no one's talking about it. So hopefully this program can help empower everybody to go out there and have conversations about this, because if you're waiting for your doctor to have that conversation, you may never have it. So it's really, you know, and it's a hard topic. So then to be able to have that strength to be able to say it, because now you're having to look and face your own mortality that, you know, is going to inevitably happen. The plane will land. And so how do you do that? So sometimes that's hard. And then if you're the family member, sort of that lone one out there saying maybe enough's enough, then what are your siblings going to say to you? What, you know, did you give up on mom? Did you don't care anymore? Just like even with a doctor, I'm sure that his perspective wasn't that this person's a cop-out, but they're trained to heal and get better and keep trying, and there's always another procedure, instead of taking a step back and saying, but wait a minute, what do you want? Here's your options. That is one option, the option to keep going. I'm sure that you can always find another way to keep going. But there are other options out there, and that's not discussed enough.
And it just occurred to me as you were talking that, and Judy as well, that we want to promote these conversations between patients and their doctors, and we want to do what we can. When that was put into the healthcare bill, in the recent healthcare legislation, it's actually still in there, that was called death panels. And it's I think that was a very cynical approach to trying to do anything possible to undermine healthcare reform. But they took what is perhaps the most American idea, the idea of choice and being the ruler of your own destiny, and turned it into some concept that the government would set up panels that would decide who could live and who would die. And I think it's a very cynical approach to that. But that's sort of a policy issue that really could help, that would pay doctors, if you will, to have these conversations with patients and to really allow people to have that choice. I mean, it occurred to me as I was thinking about this, I thought, what could be more American, regardless of which side of the political aisle you sit on, than the idea of choice? And I was thinking, you know, I wouldn't want my children to choose my clothes, let alone decide what kind of care I got at the end of life if I had an opinion. And I thought, that's incredibly American, and yet here it was being shot down. But that is still part of it, and I guess that's one of the kinds of policy changes that could really promote this. And Judy, do you know any more about sort of where that stands, or you know, just this idea of promoting this and supporting doctors and patients to have these conversations?
Yeah, so at this point, you know, the health care reform bills are moving through each side of Congress. And on the House side, there's one health care reform bill, and it does have language in it that would allow physicians to be paid for having this conversation. On the Senate side, there's two versions that are moving forward, and neither one has this in it. So what we anticipate is that the Senate will come down to one bill, and the House bill will move forward, and those two will go to conference committee. So when they go to conference committee, because it's in the House bill, it will be under consideration, and we're cautiously optimistic that it will continue and that it will be in the final version of health care reform and be enacted.
Great. Thank you. There's a question just about sort of specific documents. We talked a lot about Pulse, which has been a tremendous advance in the state of California. I have to say, it's really making a big difference and really is a wonderful advance in this area to have a document that really is respected in all healthcare situations. But a question came up about other documents. There are lots of them around. If you look on the web, you'll find many of them, five wishes, other advanced care directives, and so on. And any comments about those as we go forward, advantages of one over the other, or are all of them equally good? Is it more important to do one than to do none? Sharon, any thoughts, comments about that?
Sure. I do know about five wishes. I also really like, they're called Go Wish cards, and they're kind of like a deck of cards that talk about different things that could happen at the end of life and what your value is. So you can, what I do is I can use them with families to say, okay, here's this deck. Look at all these different choices about what you may or may not, and sort of rate them. Like, I think there's about 30 or 40 cards. And then you can rate, find your top 10 and then find your top 3. It's really hard to do. But an example of one of them on there is to die pain-free, to die with family at my side, to die with my chaplain at my side. So there's all these different choices. And then it helps families kind of talk about that. Like, I didn't know that you would pick that, or I didn't know. And it's a good thing I also use for teaching. So we use those when I'm teaching other professionals how to have these conversations with the families that they may be working with, to rate and take a look at themselves and about what their values are and how to use that. So they're very cheap to buy, and they're really a useful tool to use to open up conversation.
I'm just thinking, these preferences made me think of Woody Allen, who said once, "I don't mind dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens." But you talked about sort of very general things about, I want to die pain-free, I want to be with my loved ones, but there's nothing really there about, I didn't hear you say anything about dialysis or what kind of antibiotics I would want or how many blood draws I would want at the end of my life. And so to what extent is that important, to sort of specify that level of detail about what you want versus what you were just talking about, which is much more global sort of values, things, you know, bigger picture things that are important to me? And how should people be thinking about that?
We'd recommend generally that it's the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. For most people, that's what they can get their hands around, and that's what's helpful to their loved ones and their healthcare team when they're making decisions. There are some people who have had so much experience with loved ones, or as a nurse or physician themselves, with seeing people die, that they can get really specific. That's quite unusual, because we don't know how any individual will die. We don't know what the choices are about treatment that we're going to have to face in your particular death. And what are those treatment decisions that your loved ones will have to make? So we found that the broader conceptual values tends to be more helpful at the time of death.
Yeah, in the role of the physician and the nurse and this, all of us who work in the healthcare, is to help people understand what those choices might mean. When you look at the Pulse, it talks about CPR. If you have the television view of it, it's always successful. But in real life, it can be very painful to people, especially very old people, when our bodies are much more frail. So it's important. We talk about allowing a natural death. That sounds nicer, doesn't it? Much nicer. And there are consequences. People often, when people stop eating, at the end of life, it's a natural thing for us to want to stop eating. But it wants to feed you. So should we put in a tube or not? And there's we found that there's, in many cases, it may be beneficial, but in many, many cases, it's not so. So I think a role of my role as a nurse and Stephen's role is to educate people about, is this a good thing to do? Well, this is what we know. This is what your values are. How can we make it work for you?
Yeah. And I think getting back to this idea of sort of all the specifics, of course, we can't possibly know specifically what will happen in all the interventions. And sort of I sort of think of the things we do as sort of agnostic. They're neither good nor bad. Being on a breathing machine is neither good nor bad. It's just what will it do for you? Will it help you achieve that goal of dying pain-free or of living to see your granddaughter be born or doing something that matters to you? And the treatments themselves are usually pretty effective. The question is, what will they do for you? And it also, I think, points to something you said earlier, Judy, which is the importance of appointing someone who can speak for you, because you can't anticipate what's going to happen in every possible way. But having someone there who really knows you and knows your values is incredibly important to help make those decisions at a time when you can't make them for yourself. And I think what these documents about are as importantly naming the person who will decide for you as much as talking about the specific kind of care you'd want. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're talking about the decisions at the end of life and about how to take care of people who are facing the end of life. Our panelists are Kathy Kelly, coordinator for ELNEC, which is the End of Life Nursing Education Consortium geriatric program at the City of Hope; Judy Sitko, executive director of the California Coalition for Compassionate Care; and Sharon Fernikes-Jeans, a licensed social worker and manager of social work services and spiritual care at Eden Medical Center in Castro Valley, California. I'm Dr. Stephen Panilat, professor of clinical medicine at University of California, San Francisco. We've had a couple questions now about aid in dying, if you will. Is end-of-life pill, is there such a thing? Is it a reality in California or only in Oregon? And what is the place of aid in dying in this topic? And I know this can be a very heated topic, but seems to be one on people's minds. So maybe we should just touch on it briefly here. Judy, do you have any comments about the issue of aid in dying and how to think about that?
California, to date, has not enacted legislation that authorizes physician aid in dying or physician-assisted suicide, depending on which side of the issue you stand on. It is legalized in Oregon and a few other states. There is an active movement in California, and there's no specific legislation pending on this issue at this time. But I know that there is some activity, behind the scenes from a political standpoint. The proponents are very committed to that legislation.
Either. No. I guess when I get asked about this not infrequently about this issue, and what I like to say is that regardless of what you think about that particular issue and whether that should be available or not as a legal option, what we know is that providing good care to patients means that fewer people want that option. And the experience in Oregon shows us that. They have data that suggests that when patients make the request, it is often in response to pain that's not relieved or suffering in one way or another, and that if we treat depression, if we treat pain well, and if we make referrals to hospice, that those requests become far fewer. And I think apropos of our discussion today, the opportunity to talk with family, with loved ones, with doctors and nurses about what it is that's important to us, what we are worried about when facing the end of life, and knowing that we can get good symptom management, good care, and that our dignity will be protected and defended as we face the end of life, deals with the vast majority of these requests. And they turn out to be very rare in Oregon anyway. But regardless of what you think of that issue, we should all be proponents for good palliative care for patients. Mrs. May is Chinese-American. There were some issues, perhaps, some specific issues that came up because of that. But we live in an incredibly diverse country, a very diverse state. How do those issues play out, and how can we kind of think about those issues so that palliative care is not just kind of dominated by some idea of what's right and how we should be doing things, but really takes into account the great diversity of cultural and religious ideas and thoughts about how that sort of plays out with patients and what we need to be thinking about to be respectful of people's cultural backgrounds.
First Sharon, off, ask. So lots of times people assume, oh, well, if you're this ethnic background or this culture, then this is what they would want. But nobody's asking the question, what do you want? Because just because you may be of a certain ethnic background doesn't necessarily mean you follow those traditions or cultural views. So really, I like to ask people about their culture. What do you celebrate? How do you see this happening? What would you want to do? And then follow those as guidelines and share that with the rest of the medical team. They may not have had the opportunity or may not have asked what someone would want. People want to do very different things when someone is dying, and how do we find a place to honor that and make that happen? For example, sometimes people want to wash the body. Sometimes people want to apply a lotion or, like with Miss May, put on new clothes that maybe she had been a part of picking out or that was a special or culturally significant. So we have to find out what the people want and come from where they are at, not necessarily assume just because they are of a certain culture that is what they would want. So I really start off by asking.
That's great. Kathy?
No, I would agree the same thing. And also in healthcare providers, those of us who are taking care of you, is that we have to know where our cultural background is and not let that dictate what happens. So it's becoming culturally sensitive, and it's that communication piece then to the rest of the team that's so important.
Yeah, just to emphasize what Sharon and Kathy have described might be called cultural humility. California is such a diverse state. There's no way that anyone could be culturally competent in every culture. And as Sharon mentioned, you know, you can't assume that just because someone comes from a particular culture that they follow those beliefs. And as Kathy said, part of that cultural humility is knowing that what is your culture? Where do you come from? Everybody actually has their own unique culture, so the way to be culturally humble is to know and just approach them as an open book and just hearing who they are. I also just like to point out that when Dr. Panlat described Mrs. May, part of me said, oh, perhaps she's Chinese. Now, again, we want to go with a very open mind, but sometimes it's helpful to know that some of these different beliefs are, and that we've found when we've worked with Chinese Americans that a lot of them don't want to have a death in the house, because it's bad luck for selling the house. And so while general studies show that 80% of people want to die at home, that may not always be true. Some people do not want to. So we just need to be very open about what are the assumptions that we have about what constitutes a good death.
I think related to that, Judy, because we hear that as well. But then I had colleagues visiting from Beijing, from the medical college in Beijing. And so I asked them that question. I said, you know, this is something we see in the U.S., and I'm wondering, how do you deal with this in China? I said, where do people die in China? He goes, they die at home. What do you think? Of course they die at home. I mean, there's no hospital, you know, there's not enough hospitals for everyone to die in a hospital. And so I think there are just very interesting, you know, how culture sort of plays out, and perhaps the best thing that I've learned over time is to ask the questions and not assume anything, because that's the only way you make a mistake is if you assume. We have last question here, turning to sort of the very practical. You want hospice services for you or your loved one, or you want to fill out this pulsed form or the five wishes or other advanced directives, or you want a book about how to take care of your loved one. Can we some of your sort of best references and best sources for the practical about where people can look for this kind of care? If they get admitted to a hospital, what do you ask for or look for? If you want hospice, how do you get it? Things like that. So maybe why don't we just run through the panel. Kathy, ideas about that?
Well, if you think your family is ready for hospice, you can ask for a hospice referral from your physician. But when I worked with oncology patients, I said you can always call them and ask yourself. And it's important to know that hospice gives a lot of support to caregivers and families after the death of the person, and that's really important to know. And also, you can go in and out of hospice. You can have it for a while, and if you decide you want to go back into curative treatment, you can. It's our choice. You can need to learn that. I also, in terms of end-of-life care, I've used our government has great resources. Your Council on Aging has great resources. There are caregiver resources out there. This is terrible. You could Google it and go on. But I also turn to our California Coalition for Compassionate Care. They have a great website, and I use that a lot. So I'll let Judy talk about that.
Thank you for that plug. So the website for the California Coalition for Compassionate Care is www.finalchoices.org. And Final Choices is one word. We do have links to a number of different advanced directives, so you can go on there and look at the various ones and pick one that you are most comfortable with. The POLST website is www.capolst.org.
Great. Thank you. Sharon?
And I also wanted to point out, with an advanced health care directive, you do not need an attorney to do this. You do not need a notary to do this. So it is something that you can do yourselves. There is specific on who can witness this. One of the witnesses cannot be related to by blood, marriage, adoption. But you can also call your local hospital and ask to speak with a social worker there. They can help guide you and point you in the right direction of where you might need something. I get calls every single day. My mom lives there. I live in Minnesota. What do I do for her around this? So it's really our job to help you with the community resources out there, even if you're not in the hospital. We do that. And if you're in the hospital, we sit down with you and help you fill out all of these forms. So it's a really good way to navigate through that. And also the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization has a great website and a lot of different tools that you can use and reading books and different stuff that you might want to have.
Yeah, and I think they're at www.nhpco.org. There's also a wonderful website by the Center to Advance Palliative Care that's called getpalliativecare.org. That's another one, getpalliativecare.org. Palliative is PALLIATIVE. Getpalliativecare.org. I think calling your local hospice is a great one. Just pick up the phone and call. If you wait for your doctor sometimes to refer you, you'll get referred, but within the last 7 days of death and not earlier. So calling. And if you get admitted to the hospital, ask for palliative care services. I would really encourage people to do that. You don't have to be like Mrs. May at the end of life. I mean, if you just have serious symptoms that need alleviating, if you want to talk to someone about the future and what that holds, ask for the palliative care services. Chances are, if you just get admitted to a hospital in California, there's about a 40% chance that they offer palliative care services. If you get admitted to a large not-for-profit hospital, you have about a 70% chance of finding one with a palliative care service. And increasingly, even if you get admitted to a public hospital, you will find palliative care services through an initiative by the California Healthcare Foundation. So I think increasingly, Californians have access to these services, and we have to ask about them. As for a book, Handbook for Mortals by Joanne Lynn, I think is a very nice guide for people to think about what happens to you and your loved one as you go through this process. Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we are running out of time. Our plane is about to land, if you will. As we heard today, palliative care can deliver better quality of care for people with life-threatening illness. The healthcare debate has really focused a great deal of attention on improving the quality of care for people with life-threatening illness and improving quality more generally. And while palliative care is not going to be the answer to all of the healthcare problems, it is certainly an important part of the solution to improving quality and does so in a way that provides greater caring, compassion, empathy, and hope, all qualities that are often in short supply in medicine generally and society at large. I want to thank our panelists, Kathy Kelly, who's coordinator for the ELNEC, End of Life Nursing Education Consortium, geriatric program at City of Hope, Judy Sitko, executive director of the California Coalition for Compassionate Care, and Sharon Fernikes-Jeans, licensed social worker and manager of social work services and spiritual care at Eden Medical Center in Castro Valley, California. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. This program is generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. While our conversation today was on the end of life, so that we could better understand how to provide compassionate care and maintain and foster hope and dignity for people who are living with life-threatening illness. The real gift of this conversation and of palliative care generally and the conversations that it promotes, including ones about end of life, is how it focuses us not about how we want to die, but really about how we want to live. And that's the ultimate gift. The knowledge that one day the plane is going to land need not make the flight less enjoyable. But in many ways, knowing that it can land gently can make the wonder of flight and our time in the air even more precious and more enjoyable, because we appreciate every moment along the way. And that sort of optimistic note about how focusing on the end really makes every day better, or has the potential to make every day better, I want to close with a quote that's attributed to Mark Twain. I say attributed because there's a lot attributed to him that may or may not be right. But this is attributed to Mark Twain that makes the point that life is a gift, and that how we spend our time matters, and that the knowledge that life is limited reminds us to live according to our passion today and not wait for the tomorrow that is never guaranteed. Sing like no one's listening. Dance like no one's watching. Love like you've never been hurt. Live like it's heaven on earth. I'm Dr. Stephen Panelat, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.